From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Facebook was a dorm room dream. Then it was a social networking phenom, an online world of friends and likes and personal status reports that has drawn in 900 million users. Now it's headed for its IPO, the big payout moment when a big public valuation is stamped across the company. What you think it's worth depends on how you see the future and Mark Zuckerberg's dream now. This hour, On Point, putting a public price on Facebook. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to invest? At what price? Does Facebook look golden to you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us first today from San Francisco is Shandy Reyes, technology reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's been keeping a close watch on Facebook's ramp-up to the IPO. Shandy, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Give us the nuts and bolts first, if you would. Where are we in this process? What's going on?
Sure. Well, late last week, what happened was Facebook put out a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission where they gave a price range for what they think they're worth. And that range is between $77 billion and $96 billion. And they are offering their shares to the public at a price of about $28 to $35. And so now the process is that's beginning this morning is Facebook's senior executives are on what's called a roadshow where the executives meet with investors and their bankers go along with them, and the investors grill the executives and say, you know, well, why do you think you're worth this much money and how are you going to make that money? And then the investors talk to the bankers and say, well, we want this many shares. And the bankers collect a book. It's what they call it, a book. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of this roadshow, the company is going to come out with another price, which is what they're actually going to go public at. And it's going to be somewhere in that range.
Right.
And that's based on what the investors have told them. Now, one really important thing to keep in mind is that after going on this roadshow, they could see that all the investors are willing to pay an awful lot of money for Facebook and come out with an even higher valuation and an even higher price. So although we have this $77 billion to $96 billion range, we could end up with something much higher.
Now, even at this range, you report, Shandy, this would be the largest valuation for a U.S. company at the time of an initial public offering ever.
Yeah, that's correct. That's according to Dealogic, which follows tracks IPOs. It's pretty unbelievable.
That was UPS was the biggest one to date,
yeah,
$60 billion or so, a long time ago. So,
yeah.
So here's Facebook. Gosh, so many questions about this. What's the calendar here? What's the May 18th they're hoping to do this? Is that set?
May 18th is when yes. So they go on this roadshow today.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be in New York today. They're going to have a lunch. And then I think they're headed to Boston tomorrow. And then they're going to be back here in the Bay Area in Palo Alto after that. And then the idea is on May 17th, that's when, remember I was saying they have this book, and then they kind
right.
of whittle it down and figure out exactly what the price is. So May 17th, that night, they'll file with the Securities and Exchange Commission what the final price is going to be. And then on Friday, May 18th, they'll ring the bell, and that'll be the first day of trading.
So it all depends on what the final price is. But in this range, about what are they looking to raise here for the company to have cash in its tank?
So the high range would be something like $13 billion plus. The low range would be like $10.1 billion.
And that's for the company. And what about, there's a lot of individuals who are going to become, they're already wealthy on paper. This will put a lot of cash in their hands as well. But what about the value of shares for individuals and early investors that we're likely to see on the other side of this?
So some of these people have made like 900 times their investment. People like Jim Breyer from the venture capital firm Accel is one of the big winners here. Obviously, Mark Zuckerberg is, you know, going to be worth something like $18 billion. He's going to be selling some shares for the purposes of taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Even Sheryl Sandberg, she is not fully vested, which means that she actually doesn't own all her shares yet.
This is the chief operating officer, though.
She's the mm-hmm. chief operating officer, correct. She's like second in command mm-hmm. to Mark Zuckerberg and responsible for sort of making money off of Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg focuses mostly on the product.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to be one of the few female billionaires in the world. after this IPO, at least on paper.
What about, will there be a whole litter of millionaires newly minted around?
That's something that Silicon Valley people here are eagerly waiting for, the jewelry shops and the car shops and all of the real estate agents and yacht dealers, because there are a lot of employees at Facebook who have been there for a very long time, and they haven't been able to sell their shares. You can sell your shares if you're a former employee.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've been just holding on and kind of, you know, waiting all these years. And actually, one of the reasons that Mark Zuckerberg has said that he wants to go public is because he really feels like he owes it to the employees at this point. It's been 8 years, and they have no liquidity. They have no way of, you know, making money unless they want to leave the company. And so in order to retain the talent, he has to give them this currency. So they're going to be many, many, many millionaires. I'm working on a story about it right now, so you'll find out soon how many there are going
to
be.
You say all these years, and of course 8 years is a long time to wait when you're young. On the other hand, 8 years ago, he was a kid in a dorm room, and on the other side of this, he will presumably be one of the richest individuals on the planet. And one of the peculiarities here, Shandy, is this is very unusual for startup companies, that here we are at the IPO, and on the other side of it, by all accounts, Mark Zuckerberg will still hold the majority of shares in the company, 55%+ controlling share.
Yes. I think that it's something that I've written a lot about. And when I speak to investors, people who are now potentially going to invest in this IPO, they sort of laugh at me because they think that, oh, it's not a big deal. I mean, even though this is sort of goes against every corporate governance rule in the book, I think investors, especially in the technology sector, are used to Google, where Sergey Brin and Larry Page, have 10-to-1 voting rights, and there's been a whole slew of IPOs before Facebook. Zynga, the social game maker that built mm-hmm. games on Facebook, and then you had Groupon, the Daily Deal site. Both of those companies have tremendous power centered with the founders. I think that Mark Zuckerberg, it's a little unusual in the sense that it's obviously such a high-profile company, and so it's a bit surprising. And I think the place where we really saw it the most was actually this Instagram acquisition a few weeks ago. Basically, Mark Zuckerberg spent a weekend holed up in his house with this young entrepreneur named Kevin Systrom and decided over the course of that weekend to pay $1 billion for a photo sharing app that had about 30 million users and absolutely no revenue.
Right.
he didn't consult his board. He talked to Sheryl Sandberg, his COO, but he didn't really involve her in the negotiations at all. He did it himself, and then when the deal was done, he called up his board members and he said, hey guys, guess what? We're going to do the biggest acquisition we've ever done before.
Amazing. Didn't consult his board because he didn't have to, and he won't have to, even on the other side of the IPO. Everybody saw the movie, or lots of people. What about his college days partner, Eduardo Severin? What will he come out of this with?
Well, Eduardo, actually, his stake has been reduced somewhat because he sold a bunch of it to the Russian investor Yuri Milner.
Right.
And so he only has about 2% of the company. Now, obviously, when I say only, I mean we're still talking about close to $2 billion. But Eduardo has sort of left the tech world to a certain extent. He's off living a playboy life in Singapore, and we had a great story the other day that I would highly recommend everybody to check out because it got crazy traffic, and it was all about sort of the playboy that Eduardo has become.
And what about, you mentioned Zynga and Groupon, people talk about tech bubble. What about mm-hmm. Facebook in that big question mark?
It's interesting because when I speak to people about the idea of the tech bubble, Facebook is the one company that they don't think is in the bubble. Facebook is a company that has real revenues and has real profits. Now, of course, they had $3.7 billion in revenue last year and $1 billion in profit. That gives them a 27% profit margin. That's really not bad. The question is, are they going to be able to grow into this $100 billion valuation? And I think that it's certainly it's certainly possible that they will. It's just that they have a lot of things they have to accomplish before they can get there, and they're not clearly on that path because there's all sorts of things that they haven't really focused on. One is the biggest problem I see right now is that they have one source of revenue, and that's advertising. It makes up 85% of their business. The other problem is that their payments business, which is obviously if you're a social game maker, so Zynga, mm-hmm. you pay Facebook 30% of your revenue, and that's where the rest of their revenue comes from. But Zynga right now is really the only social game maker that's had any success on Facebook, and so Zynga actually makes up 12% of all of Facebook's revenue, one company. Wow. So that's not a good thing. They have really no mobile strategy. So they have a lot of challenges. Doesn't mean they won't overcome them. I think where Facebook creates a bubble is actually among the other startups in Silicon Valley, because what happens is, you know, when startups and entrepreneurs and investors see mm-hmm. that companies like Facebook are willing to pay $1 billion, or companies like Zynga, which just spent $180 million on a small, mobile app, what they see is an opportunity for an exit. They're hoping that these big companies are going to buy them. And so that exit opportunity gets calculated into the valuation of these young companies, and obviously not every company is going to be bought by Facebook, and Mark Zuckerberg himself has said that he has no intention of doing lots of big billion-dollar acquisitions, but that does change the valuations in the Valley, and so that's where I think you're seeing some frothiness, as we call it.
Right. He can say what he likes, but he just did it, $1 billion for Instagram, and now Facebook on the home stretch to an initial public offering, an IPO. Shandy Race with The Wall Street Journal in San Francisco. It's great to have you with us, Shandy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Facebook heading for its IPO, initial public offering, readying to sell shares to the general public at maybe the highest debut corporate valuation in this country ever. Very likely to be exactly that. Let's listen to just a little bit from Facebook is out with its roadshow this week, heading around the country, talking with big investors. Everybody will be kind of listening in. They've got a video out. And here's something from that video. Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg touting Facebook's ability to reach millions of users.
Facebook offers unparalleled reach. We have over 900 million monthly active users worldwide, giving people the ability to spark global conversations about ideas, social movements, products, or services. In the United States, every day on Facebook is like the season finale of American Idol, the most popular show on television, times two.
Every day is like the finale of American Idol. And Mark Zuckerberg himself, founder, CEO, everybody knows his story from the movie and well beyond. He talks in the same video about the reach and power now of Facebook, the company, its position.
We've really reached this inflection point recently where now most companies, they're getting started, can rely on Facebook and know that the vast majority of their users are going to be on Facebook and have their connections there already. And that enables this huge amount of innovation to be unlocked.
Unlock innovation with Facebook owning that environment. Let's stay on the big picture here. Joining us from San Francisco is Richard Waters, West Coast editor for the Financial Times. In 2004, he was named Corporate Finance Reporter of the Year for his coverage of Google's IPO. Now he's all over Facebook's public offering. Richard Waters, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Tom.
And from New York, David Kirkpatrick, tech thinker, founder of the annual Techonomy Conference, spent a lot of time with Mark Zuckerberg, another big Facebook figure, writing his book, The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. David Kirkpatrick, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Richard Waters, first to you. How do we look at this? It's so much money, and yet we've seen other things come and go in the social space before. We think MySpace, we think Friendster. How does Facebook make the claim, when it's got a lot more growth to come to justify this, that it will be, you know, right there in the center of it for a long time, cashing in like crazy?
Well, I think there are two really big questions that you have to focus on if you want to put any money into this company. You know, let's put aside for a minute the fact that it has incredible reach, 900 million users, that they spend so much time on the site. We know all of that. Mm-hmm. The questions are, can they make money out of that? And will they be around for the long term? The first one is the most immediate question, and you can bet that that is exactly what all these investors are asking this week on the roadshow. The facts are these. Facebook is worth, we imagine it's going to be worth half as much as Google, and yet Google has 10 times the advertising revenue, or 10 times the revenue of Facebook. Facebook has great potential, but what it hasn't proved is it can fulfill that. And the potential is that it can infiltrate adverts into the conversation. It can get into the relationships that you have with your friends and somehow give brands this chance to leverage social influence, that the influence you have over your friends can somehow help their message. And if that sounds a bit messy, it is, because obviously a lot of users don't want to be co-opted by advertising. And the advertisers haven't yet found a way to do this. Facebook hasn't found a way to do this and prove that it works. And so this massive advertising potential is, well, I don't want to say completely unproven, but is very largely unproven. So that's one very big question. And then the second one you alluded to is, you know, will this site be around for the long term? And you just have to pause and look back over the last 15 years. All the big internet companies that have relied on community and networks, AOL, which was very heavily an email and instant messaging system, that was the glue that brought a lot of people there. MySpace, you mentioned, Friendster, many other things, they fade. And the question is why? If your friends are there and you keep going back, why do you turn your back on these things and eventually go somewhere else? And, you know, at this moment of great power for Facebook, I think we have to ask that question. Will we still in 5 years' time be going here to meet our friends rather than somewhere else?
Big questions there around its advertising revenue strategy and the risk of a fade. And I guess in the midst of all this also, just this is where a lot of our social life takes place these days. It's not just about money. It's about the way we live and get things done. David Kirkpatrick, what about the rationale, the justification from Facebook? Does it sound potent? What is it? And does it sound potent enough to you to justify the kind of huge valuations we're talking about here?
Well, first of all, there's nothing fundamentally mathematical about a valuation that's this much bigger than the current revenues and profits. It's based on a real article, making a leap of faith that is a very large leap of faith. Nothing that Richard said is something I would disagree with, but I would focus more even on what you just said, Tom, about the way we live. Really, in a way, you can look at Facebook as being a sort of all-or-nothing bet that there is a transition happening in the digital society we live in, which really goes beyond the internet itself, where identity and connections to our friends is going to matter no matter what we do. If you believe that, which they do at Facebook, then there, you know, really could potentially be no upper bound to what this thing is worth, because they are attempting to become, in my opinion, the best way to describe it is an identity infrastructure for the planet. Now, that is an extremely overreaching kind of hubristic even goal, but that is the way that Mark Zuckerberg thinks about it.
Take that apart. What does that mean, an identity infrastructure for the planet?
Well, first of all, Facebook is the first time that people have used their real names on the internet, and that has become routine now because Facebook has become routine for all of us. But before Facebook came along, the internet was an anonymous place. Everyone used pseudonyms and handles and things like that. Now, not only do we have a place where we're comfortable using our real name and our real information, but we also have this, what they call at Facebook, a social graph, the connections to all of our friends, and that is a set of assets that we can effectively take with us around the internet and around the world, because we are all now increasingly on mobile devices which are connected to the internet all the time. And so that connectivity that the internet makes possible can be applied throughout the entire world. And so then the question becomes, how important would it be in the long term to have access to your friends, their thoughts, their ideas, their participation in literally everything you do? If you think the answer to that is it could be very valuable, then Facebook could potentially be very valuable. But I really think that it's important. And while everything Shandy said I thought was intelligent and right, and she's probably the top, you know, day-to-day, day-in and day-out reporter digging on this story, there's no other company really like Facebook, in my opinion. That's why I spent 2 years writing a book about it. You know, I've been a tech journalist for 25 years. I never saw anything like the ambition, the long-term view, and the potential that Facebook represented and that its CEO Mark Zuckerberg brought to the table. So there's really no real comparison. I think a lot of the discussion about Facebook's IPO wrongly compares it to other companies in ways that I don't really think are relevant, especially companies like Groupon or Zynga or even LinkedIn. I mean, the only companies that you can legitimately compare Facebook to are Google and Microsoft and Apple. And I don't really think there's anybody else in that league.
Maybe
Amazon.
You may be right, but we also know that kingdoms, empires come and go. So nobody is beyond the sands of time. That advertising strategy key, and it's based on, I mean, users are in a way the product that they're selling to advertisers. And here's a little tape from Sheryl Sandberg, the Facebook COO, talking about the power of that targeted demographics, 90% accuracy, she says on their roadshow video, unmatched corporate and consumer connections.
When you like a business page on Facebook, you're enabling that same ongoing connection. I like Sprinkles cupcakes, and I have liked them on Facebook. When they announce a new flavor, let's say Irish chocolate for St. Patrick's Day, I will see that story in my newsfeed. This is really different from traditional advertising. Almost all other forms of advertising are one time and one way. Facebook enables businesses to have active conversation with customers that are part of an ongoing and authentic relationship.
An ongoing and authentic relationship that users give Facebook every time they step up and use it. Richard Waters, does that make them special? Does that make them immune from the next big thing?
Well, if they can make it work, it makes them special. But as I mentioned before, I think to actually get users to co-opt your message and pass it on to your friends is an incredibly difficult thing to do. We all put on Nike T-shirts or we display other brands because they become part of our lifestyle. And so, yes, we, you know, to some extent, we're prepared to go along with this. But Facebook wants much more. They want to actually plant their messages into our communication streams with our friends. And they want to show us in adverts. So if I like Nike or if I do something, engage with Nike online, Facebook wants to put me in a Nike advert and show me to my friends. And I think this is such a hard thing to do in an authentic way, to use Sheryl Sandberg's words.
Authentic, I guess the basis for that assertion, David Kirkpatrick, is that they know what people are up to because people are saying it right there by name on Facebook. So if you're running in Nikes and talking about it or liking it, that's shareable. They know everything you've got up there.
Yeah, I mean, and it's totally right to say this is an extremely hard thing to achieve, and I'm not predicting they will succeed. I didn't mean to say before that I'm certain this will happen. I'm telling you, this is the bet you have to make as a shareholder of Facebook, and that's why I think to some extent it is an all-or-nothing bet. Either Facebook essentially establishes itself and burrows in as part of the infrastructure of modern life, or else there's no way it's worth 25 times revenues at the time of its IPO. And, you know, I think that it can legitimately be argued that they have the potential to do that. And, you know, what Richard is saying is right. It's very hard to argue that it's going to be – you can't say that it's easy to maintain the authenticity of the interactions that they're seeking to facilitate. But the success they've had so far – was not predicted by much of anyone. And the fact that they got to 900 million plus in a little more than 8 years is an astonishing new development. So the judgments that they've made thus far, one has to accept, have been extremely good. So whether they can achieve that further as they really attempt to look at the entire planet as their a landscape of action, I don't know. But I can tell you that's the way Zuckerberg thinks about it every morning when he wakes up. How do I get to all 7 billion people on the planet?
A lot of people put a lot of money already into that vision. Not everybody's buying it. Here's Eric Jackson in Forbes columnist. They're saying, we think of Google and Facebook as web gorillas. They'll be around forever. Yet with the rate that the tech world is moving these days, there are good reasons to think that both might be gone completely in 5-8 years, not bankrupt, gone, but MySpace gone. There's a huge range of possibilities here. Let's bring our listeners in. Paul in Selins Grove, Pennsylvania. Paul, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was public broadcasting. Radio in particular uses Facebook a lot. I often hear, like us on Facebook, and I'm just wondering if it's working for you and what exactly you're getting out of it. More listeners, more money, and how exactly it works when we like you on Facebook. What exactly does that do for you?
Well, I think that's related to what...
Pragmatic question.
It's very pragmatic. It's related to what all kinds of organizations are thinking about. I mean, so much of people's lives and perceptions and what they're sharing about the world has migrated to Facebook. I think, Richard Waters, the sense out there is that if you don't have some presence on Facebook, you're not in the flow of a lot of people's daily living and thinking and communication.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, this is one thing that nobody's going to disagree about, which is that more and more people are being influenced by what they see on Facebook and what their friends are saying and their what they're reading, what they're liking, what they're getting interested in is being influenced by that. The problem is making money out of that. At least this is a problem only if you look at it in terms of an IPO. If you look at it in terms of the benefit they're bringing to the world or the influence they're having on people's lives, it's tremendous. But let's just think about this in terms of money. Companies have learnt or are learning how to do this, how to make influence on Facebook without spending a penny. They set up a page, they put like buttons on their other web pages, and they drive traffic, and it's working absolutely tremendously. But they're not paying for it.
That's our case. We're on Facebook because we like to bring more listeners into our fold, and if our Facebook followers are communicating with others, that they may bring more people to listen and engage and call in and comment, which just grows the conversation. But we're not advertisers, David, and many are not. Can Facebook crowbar everybody in there with, you know, dollars on the barrel head?
Well, there's a lot of untapped revenue opportunity for Facebook. Again, if they can execute deftly, and we all know they've made a number of mistakes. Mark has made a number of mistakes. And one of the oddities of the whole thing is one guy is going to be responsible for all these decisions because he controls 57% of the voting power. But okay, they have this touted advertising methodology that Cheryl's talking about in the segment you played. Mm-hmm. There is an entirely different opportunity that they could tap, which they haven't yet, because they are a platform, which is one of the most essential things that they represent, a platform for things that others put on the internet, like NPR stations or Pinterest or Instagram, both of which grew so quickly because of their connectivity with Facebook. And because they have all those connections, if they could induce companies, websites, not NPR, but others, to allow them to place ads on those sites that they put a like button on and other connection methodologies, they could become the biggest internet ad distribution network, which they have never specifically tried to do yet, but they have a potential to do it with tremendous effectiveness. That's one way that is still a completely untapped revenue opportunity. Another one is something that Shandy referred to, which is their financial system, what they call Facebook credits, which are currently really only used, with few exceptions, for purchasing virtual goods and games. But because everybody on Facebook has access to these credits and they're in every country on the planet and they're going over a billion in people, it's easy to imagine the possibility that those credits could potentially be used for other things. I was once talking to someone from Coca-Cola, a very senior person, who said, at Coke, we definitely believe that at some point you will be able to buy a Coke with Facebook credits. Now, that may be not true, but if it does become true, you know, at the moment, Facebook takes 30% of every transaction. Now, they wouldn't take 30% if you bought a Coke, but it just goes to show there, because of the reach these people have, they have opportunities, if they choose to tap into them, that are very, very large.
Facebook credit, that would be a kind of currency online.
It is a currency. They have it. They own a currency that is available to 900+ million people around the world, which is therefore interesting because it's a global currency. We don't know what that really means. I mean, money is another thing like Facebook that is in very rapid transition right now because of all the things that Richard and I write about all the time. I mean, the digital world is transforming a lot of stuff all at once. And Facebook, though, has a lot of ability to tap into various elements of that.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Facebook heading for its IPO, its initial public offering, readying to sell shares to the general public at maybe the highest debut corporate valuation in this country ever. Richard Waters is with us, West Coast editor for the Financial Times. He's been covering this upside and down. David Kirkpatrick joins us from New York, author of The Facebook Effect. He spent a lot of time with the company, with Mark Zuckerberg, founder and CEO. Just 8 years ago, he was a college student thinking about this in a dorm room. Now, well, he'll be one of the richest men in the world. I mean, he already is, I suppose. You can join us. Are you still wishing you'd thought the whole thing up in your dorm room in the year 2004? Let's go to our listeners. Carrie in Montpelier, Vermont. Carrie, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I recently joined Facebook and really appreciate it for being able to spread the message about my nonprofit. But I have a number of friends who are experiencing Facebook fatigue. Basically, they're tired of going through their news feeds every day, even though they love their friends, love their causes, and they just want to be off the computer a little bit more and in the real world, so to speak. So I'm wondering if the investors are taking that into consideration at all.
Facebook fatigue. Let me hold that one, Carrie. It's a great question. Let me hold it right there and get one more here from Des Moines, Iowa. Thanks, Carrie. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
My two reasons are this. I'm a writer, and I've joined a couple writers' groups on Facebook. Recently got in contact with an older friend and made a new friend. Both died. The only contact I've ever had with the one person was through Facebook, and it occurred to me upon her death that this was a real relationship, and I felt real sadness and real pain. And it's the only way I can still touch the memories of my other friend who died. So I think this thing has legs beyond just the marketing value. And as far as marketing value, I certainly don't understand how this all gets monetized. But for me personally, it allows me to put my novels out there in a small way and do a target marketing and reach the readers that I need to reach. So I don't know. I think they tapped on something. I understand the fatigue. All my friends go through that. I have one friend that like shuts his account down about every
right.
3 weeks.
Yeah, and then goes back.
But for me, when my friend died, my virtual mm-hmm. friend died, I realized this was not a virtual relationship at all. This was as real as any I've known. And that's my comment. Thanks.
Dave, I appreciate your call very much. That's interesting. Let me hold that one as well. Fatigue, real relationships, even in a virtual world, and Frankfort, Kentucky. Nick is calling. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been on Facebook for, I guess, 5 years, and, you know, I find it useful. At the same time, I feel like our loyalty is to the people and to the folks we interact with and not to a company. And I kind of feel its status as tenuous at best. I could leave any time for another service, should it appear.
Well, could you really at this point, given how invested people are in Facebook? I mean, if the next thing comes, you know, the next Friendster or you name it comes, could you really leave all that, Nick? Or would you be leaving your life behind if you left Facebook?
I think I could leave it behind. And sometimes I'm really happy to leave it behind.
Nick, I appreciate your call. All right, Richard, David, we've got lots of comments online here, on Facebook for that matter as well. Steve says, I think the stock price will fluctuate, then start a steady decline as people figure out there's not much in the way of tangible assets. Later, when the next big social media outlet takes off, you'll see investors take a bath. Christo says, you know, Facebook is old fashioned and fashions change. Richard Waters, what about that? We heard it both sides of that from our callers here.
Well, I think you can look at it two ways. One is, you know, what are the key assets of this company? What keeps people going back there? And I think of it in three terms. It's the social glue, what Facebook calls the social graph. You're connected to all your friends there. There's the identity that David mentioned, because your identity is there. You can go around the web signing in using your Facebook account, and that's really valuable. And then the third thing is all your stuff, your pictures and your comments and everything else. Yep. You've been building up over the years. So there's a lot of glue to come back to. But you know, a couple of your callers just raised that question. Will I turn my back on that and go somewhere else? And I think we already know that the answer is potentially yes. And we only have to look at the Instagram acquisition to know that. Instagram was made for mobile, which Facebook isn't. Mm-hmm. It is a very simple little photo app. where you build a new network, and millions and millions of people are going there and spending as much time, according to the Instagram founders, as they spend on Facebook. And so I think suddenly flashing before Facebook's eyes is the prospect that people really can turn their back on this thing they've invested so much time in, and they can start afresh with something that works better on an iPhone or some other smartphone. So I think that tells you.
David Kirkpatrick, what about Facebook loyalty versus Facebook fatigue? They're counting on loyalty here.
Well, first of all, what goes up must come down. The question is, how long does that take? I mean, there's no question things will reemerge that will ultimately replace, disintermediate, and cause problems for Facebook. But, you know, I think that there are several things. One is that a lot of Americans have trouble looking at Facebook as the global business that it really is. And, you know, in general also, the average user of Facebook is very happy with it. There is Facebook fatigue. People leave it all the time. It's not a common thing in Indonesia or Nigeria or South Africa or Brazil or places like that, which is where Facebook's growth is almost entirely coming right now. Mm. So I think that, you know, there's also something in business economics that we call switching costs. And Facebook is hard to get rid of. You know, for example, if you're on it with all of your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, for example, your photos. That's a very important switching cost. That my daughter, for example, who's 20, recently had a computer crash. Her lost her whole hard drive. It didn't faze her in the least. It's the first time I've ever met somebody who couldn't care about her computer dying. And she said, oh, well, the only thing I really care about are my photos, and they're all on Facebook. So,
it's, you know, true. People run back into burning houses to get photo albums. Now they don't have to. They're on Facebook.
And it also helps explain why would Facebook have felt so urgently the need to buy Instagram. And I also just want to say one more thing in respect to what Richard was saying. It's not new for them to be afraid. Facebook runs paranoid. Zuckerberg runs paranoid. He's felt from the beginning that if he didn't keep changing, keep moving, Facebook would risk irrelevance and substitution by somebody else coming out of a dorm room or a garage. This is one reason why he does have such total absolute power, controlling 57% of the voting shares. Sean Parker gave that to him at the very beginning with control of the board. One of the reasons he has so much power now is that a lot of the big holders, like his friends Dustin Moskovitz and Sean Parker, have assigned their voting power to him because they all believe that the speed of decision-making that Facebook is going to need to give to all of these problems that it encounters will really be better if one person can just make those decisions and buy Instagram in a weekend.
Yeah, of course, even so, things change. Stanley in Scarsdale, New York. Stanley, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
One observation that I think that I have, and something which is completely glossed over, having 57% of the vote of a platform which ostensibly proposes to be the platform to the world will inevitably meet up with huge government intervention, regulation. We've seen it in the railroads. We've seen it in telephones and communications. We've seen it through the electric companies, gas companies. It's story of history, and the presumption that Facebook can establish itself as a platform that all other corporations will float on and then support themselves on and have no government control of is, I think, just foolishness to even imagine that it can go that
far. Stanley, let us look at that. It's a great point. Richard Waters, how about it? Look at the history, as Stanley said, and look at AT&T and other big platforms. Governments get involved. I mean, I think China's already not even letting Facebook into China, right? It's not the
They're
big...
Not. It's an incredibly important point, and I think from two points of view. One is just the antitrust impacts here. That if Facebook does fulfill its potential and becomes a platform on which so many other companies depend, and it's a total monopoly, you can bet that regulators around the world will be crawling all over them. The other one, though, is the social impact. It was extremely interesting last week that Facebook decided to let people show whether or not they are organ donors. To declare that on their profile. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you do that, I think it adds a social It adds social pressure. And so people could start to feel obliged to show that they're organ donors, or they could be targeted by campaigners if they're not organ donors. And so you can start to see Facebook using its influence. In this case, I think surely for better, because if they can solve the waiting list for organs, it would be a tremendous benefit. But nonetheless, as soon as you start to use this incredible network for social good or ill, then who makes that decision? Who decides what is for the best? Is it just entirely Mark Zuckerberg with his 57%? And does the world want Mark Zuckerberg making those decisions?
And David, what about privacy? It's always an issue with Facebook. Governments could well become involved in it. Facebook depends on knowing a lot in order to make this advertising particularly valuable, as they say. What about that issue going forward?
Governments are becoming involved in it, especially in Europe. There's a proposed right to be forgotten, which would essentially make Facebook not work in Germany and the EU. So I agree. Regulation is the biggest challenge they face. You have very smart listeners. Every question has and comment has been great so far. And I couldn't agree more. This is the absolute biggest thing they should be worried about. But if it's, I think Richard's right also to point to the organ donor thing, because think of why they did that. They're trying to show that they can do social good, so that the regulators who might be inclined to say, hey, you know, your privacy policies, your monopoly status, which they absolutely already have, in my opinion, are really worrying us. Well, they can say, but wait a minute, look, we can help people show their organ donors, and there's going to be a lot of other stuff like that they'll introduce over time, and that others will be able to introduce on top of their platform. They will make their platform increasingly available to governments for various functions, and they already have to some degree. So It's an issue in
itself, given how much they know. They know a lot.
Oh, it's a big issue. I mean, it's a dynamic landscape, though, is the point.
People with all kinds of views. Heather from Montgomery, Alabama, is saying Facebook is hard to leave. A lot of her friends wanted to go to Google Plus, but they're still on Facebook. Donna in Cedar Falls, Iowa, it says it's got the potential to become a big means of communication between nations and cultures. Imagine, she says, if they implemented a translation program so everyone could read everyone else's pages around the planet. More to come. We'll see exactly what the valuation is when it all comes down in not so many days now. We're grateful to the two of you for helping us look ahead. David Kirkpatrick in New York, author of The Facebook Effect. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Really enjoyed it.
And Richard Waters, West Coast editor for the Financial Times. Terrific to have you, Richard. Thanks so much for being here.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
In a moment, a word for those of us who won't be making billions when Facebook goes public. That's a lot of us. This is On Point. So Facebook will go public. Millionaires and billionaires will be made by the fistful, and a whole lot of Facebook users will be left on the outside looking in. Boston Globe columnist Joanna Weiss has been thinking about that huge population.
We are all Winklevi now. You remember the Winklevi, Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, the large-chinned, well-bred, Harvard-educated twins who sued Mark Zuckerberg over Facebook on the grounds that he had kind of, sort of, stolen their idea. Well, okay, we're not completely like them. Not in the sense that when Facebook stock goes public, the court settlement they won could be worth $300 million. But we are Winklevi in the sense that we're on the outside of Facebook, looking in, with a tiny, nagging feeling that the balance isn't right. Hype about the company's impending IPO has been everywhere. Analysis of proper valuation, laundry lists of who will reap the most, from Zuckerberg to his early investors to the guy who took stock as payment for painting murals at Facebook headquarters. And with it, among a lot of people I know, has come a related phenomenon of Facebook angst, consisting of several concurrent realizations. One, some people are about to get extraordinarily rich. Two, this group does not include me. Three, why didn't I see how much the world was going to change? Plenty of folks, it turns out, have reason to feel left behind when a company like Facebook hits the stratosphere. There are analog people who didn't anticipate the speed and breadth of the digital world. As a newspaper industry exile reminded me, the papers once did what Facebook does, just more slowly. People clipped stories, sent them to friends, discussed them in the coffee shop. Old school. Then there are mid-career people facing the standard humanities profession realization. You love your job and work hard at it, but you don't make much money. Does this make you noble or a chump? Discuss. Then there are digital people who had good ideas but not perfect ones, or perfect ideas with imperfect execution. This was the plight of the Winklevi. Their idea for a Harvard dating website was Facebook-ish, but it wasn't Facebook. And then there is pretty much everyone, who give the website our time and our personal data and our preferences and our attempts at clever prose, based on which Facebook has figured out how to make billions of dollars selling ads. It's a stunningly effective business model, which is why Zuckerberg and his employees are about to get so rich. And it's not that Facebook users give away so much for absolutely nothing. For no money up front, we get a powerful tool that we can use however we want. Mobilizing world-changing movements, reconnecting with long-lost friends, stalking ex-boyfriends to see if they've gone bald. Our willingness to accept this particular trade-off says something deep about the state of the modern world. In recent years, we've grown accustomed to giving away vast amounts of information in exchange for relatively small benefits. We hand over our shopping lists to the supermarket checker via those little rewards cards in order to save a few pennies on grapes. We send our TV viewing patterns to the cable companies so we can watch shows at our leisure on our DVRs. We let Google compile vast reserves of data from our searches and our emails in exchange for getting free emails and searches. This convenience has arguably made us more connected, more able to mobilize world-changing movements, but it has also made us passive and willingly powerless. Every time Facebook makes a change, tinkering with privacy rules, reordering the way the news feed feeds us, people howl in protest for a day or two, blog ferociously, and basically relent. It's our data, but it's not our platform, after all. The few Facebook holdouts I know, yes, they still exist, have an old-fashioned, independent sensibility about the whole enterprise. They don't have time for it, they say, and there are still a few things they wouldn't mind keeping private. The rest of us have made a different calculation, and like the Winklevi, we might come away with precisely the payoff we deserve. The world was changing around us, and we knew. We let it happen. We just didn't figure out how to profit from it.
Joanna Wise is a columnist with the Boston Globe. You can find a link to her column, Facebook, Angst for the Millions, at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.